I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. Every 2 years, Guardian Australia partners with BirdLife Australia to run a brutal and controversial poll to select the nation's favourite bird. This year, everyone from former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd...
I think the Crimson Rosella is a beautiful bird. As Monty Python would say, beautiful plumage. But the bottom line is, think of Rosella tomato sauce. So I say fair shake for the Crimson Rosella.
To our very own political reporter, Amy Romikis, a barracking for their choice of bird to win.
Seagulls can live up until they're in their 30s, which means that there are seagulls that remember the 90s, who have listened to more Taylor Swift than you, who remember when Triple J was good.
Today, you'll hear from Guardian staff and readers about the chaos and beauty of living with birds, and how the past 2 years of climate disasters and pandemic-induced isolation has, for many, deepened their appreciation of Australia's native birds. Today, Bird of the Year 2021. It's Tuesday, the 5th of October.
Hey, it's Benjamin Moore, and for this year's Guardian Bird of the Year poll, I am putting in my vote for the Southern Cassowary. I'm a proud Queenslander, and when you go to far north Queensland, these birds are basically the closest thing that you'll ever see to a dinosaur, and they've got that insane talon that can and has disemboweled people. And given that humanity is encroaching on the cassowary's habitat, maybe there should be more of that.
My name's Gabriel Chan, and I am Rural and Regional Editor of The Guardian Australia.
So, Gabby, why did you adopt a pet cockatoo?
I always love cockatoos because they're such larrikins and such hoodlums, really. They're hoydens in the old English word. They're trouble. I was always attracted to them because I have this kind of strong streak of oppositional defiance myself. And so I made it known that I would love a cockatoo one day. And the owner of this cockatoo, who had had the bird all the way through his kids' childhoods, said, "Oh, you can have this cockatoo. I'll even throw in the aviary, you know, the big garden shed cage that he came in." And so thus began our beautiful, slightly troubled relationship.
And what type of cockatoo was he?
His name was Cocky, and he was a white sulphur-crested cockatoo, full of attitude.
So what was your relationship with him like at the start?
Cockies have really strong beaks, and so it was a bit sort of, I guess, tentative at first. And then as we got to know each other, we got more and more game. He was pretty polite in the beginning, and that's really what led me to start letting him out of the cage. So he started coming out more and more, and that's really when the trouble started.
What type of things did he get up to?
Well, he used to yell "Mum" a lot, because he'd grown up with these other kids. And so he'd yell "Mum" from the back door, and I would come rushing out the door because the kids were quite little, and it was quite a good impression of the kids. It was like, "Mum! Mum!"
Oh, God.
In a very kind of slightly scary way. And so I'd come rushing out the back door, and he'd be bobbing up and down on his perch like a lunatic, like, "Ha ha, got you again, got you again." You know, he'd wander around the house, you know, tapping on the glass, basically saying, "Mum, Mum, Mum, Mum." He'd look at me through the window and follow me around the house. And I don't know if this is just myth, but, like, it seems birds do bond with a particular person. And because I was the person responsible for topping up his feed and talking to him, you know, when I was hanging out clothes on the washing line, he kind of bonded with me and followed me around.
So how and when did things start to turn maybe a bit sour with Cocky?
Well, I think he decided that the cage was not for him, which is fair enough. And that would be fine if he was polite. But he wasn't very polite. And so he started hounding the dogs and forcing them back into their kennels, threatened to bite them on the feet. But they were terrified he was going to bite them. So obviously he'd given them a few nips. If we had people over for lunch, he would go around the table as people were sitting outside in the front yard and bite people on the bums, like just nip them on the bums. He would nip us on the heels if we weren't going too fast.
Did it feel a little bit intimidating? I mean, rather than funny sometimes.
Well, yeah, it was intimidating because that beak is very sharp. And anyone that's seen a Cocky's beak will know that, you know, it can take a piece out of you quite easily. So, yeah, this was escalating. We knew it was escalating, so we were trying to get him back into the cage. And one day he landed on my husband's shoulder. Husband walks back to the cage to put him back into the cage, thinking he's got the bird in the bag. And Cocky took a nip out of his ear. And just really clung on to his earlobe, you know, sending my other half flapping and yelling to get this bird off him. And then it got worse. He started waiting for my other half to come out of the back door in the mornings, and the farmer had to actually take a straw broom out with him to kind of wash him away and make sure that he didn't land on him and give him hell.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and I guess the last straw was really the lawnmower incident. So it was probably summer or spring. It was warm. I remember this day that we came to the last stand, and the farmer's on the ride-on lawnmower mowing the lawn. We're so conditioned to Cocky's behaviour by now that he's mowing the lawn while holding a straw broom to protect himself from this psychotic cockatoo that spends his time dive-bombing the farmer as he's mowing the lawn. And finally, cockatoo lands in front of the lawnmower, like daring the farmer to run him over. And I actually didn't see this, but it was related to me afterwards. But the farmer said, I really, really wanted to run him over. I really, really did. But I knew that I would be in such trouble if I ran over your beloved Cocky.
So he decided not to run him over in the end, though.
He decided not to run him over for the sake of the marriage. But we realised after that, you know, Cocky had to move on. And we passed him down to a lovely couple who love their animals, and he went to live there.
So after this slightly fraught experience with Cocky, will you be voting for the white sulphur-crested cockatoo?
No, I will not be voting for the white sulphur-crested cockatoo. There are plenty of white sulphur-crested cockatoos.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Shaw. I would have voted for the black swan because a quarter of all nesting pairs of black swan are homosexual, and it's my duty to support my people, or birds in this case, but they got knocked out. So my next vote is for the powerful owl.
Hello, this is Lydia Thorpe, a Gunai Gunditjmara and Djaparung woman. I'm on Wurundjeri lands, and I've chosen Bunjil, our creator spirit, in this important competition. Bunjil is basically regarded as a god who has been responsible for creating other totems and other living things. So Bunjil, the creator spirit, is very sacred and needs to be protected. So I invite you all as part of whoever you've or whomever, and I say whomever because it is a totem bird. A lot of those birds that you're voting on are totems. There's somebody's totem. And we learn from these birds in terms of song and dance and story. And so I encourage you when you're voting to actually observe these birds and watch how they dance and watch, listen to how they sing and start doing it yourself, and you'll feel that spirit and you'll be better connected to the country you're on.
So they're quite big. They're maybe about the size of a loaf of bread with a wingspan of a metre or so. And they're just gorgeous looking birds. They're this glossy black, almost shiny blue black. And the white is brilliant white. They've got brown eyes. My friend says they're angry red eyes, but they're not. They're brown and lovely big eyelashes, actually. But they've got a formidable intelligence, and you can see that in their eyes. I'm Lorena Allam. I'm Guardian Australia's Indigenous Affairs Editor, and I am on Team Magpie 100%.
Tell me about your house, the layout, and the wonderful visitors that you get, Lorena.
Yeah. So we've got a big long backyard. Over the back fence is a really big park. So it's prime real estate for magpies, I've learnt. So they love big open grassy spaces with big old mature gum trees because they like to nest right at the top of the gum trees. You know, the fence is only for humans. The magpies don't care. So they just see our backyard as an extension of their own territory.
How soon after you moved in did you realise that they were going to be a part of your life?
Yeah, like pretty soon. Like we were here maybe a week or two and we were just getting rid of the building, leftover building materials in the back. And so I was digging up quite a lot of the dirt to put in a garden, and they just kept coming around and watching us on the fence, and they'd go and dig through the soil because there's lots of, you know, interesting things in there you can eat. So we were kind of doing their work for them, I think. You know, they thought, oh, these great, these humans are kind of laying it off as like a buffet. So they kept coming back.
What do they do? I mean, how do they interact with you and the family?
Well, they've gotten more confident as the years have gone on. So the first year they were just sort of pottering around the garden. They come and sit on the clothesline and sing, which was really nice. And then they come to the back door and sing at the back door. And I thought, oh, wow, this is amazing. And then it dawned on me that they were probably doing that to all the houses that border the park. We were probably like their meals drive-through. The golden rule is don't feed native birds. With our magpies, we made an exception because it was clear they expected it. And if you didn't come out quick enough, they'd be tapping on the glass with their beaks, no kidding.
Has that bond kind of strengthened through, you know, this relationship over time?
They're very much a part of our lives now, and it's been such a delight because each year they bring their babies down after they're big enough to leave the nest. They bring them down and visit us. One year they had one baby who we christened Ringo because he used to like to steal my rings. If I was out working in the garden and I took them off on the, left them on the garden table, he'd come down and try and pinch them.
Was he successful?
Yeah, once he was going to fly off with it in his beak, and I had to distract him like you would with most kids with something else.
You want to give me a song?
Yeah, a song.
So I got the ring back, but felt quite honoured when they would bring their babies down to meet us, and they've done it every single year since we've been living here.
I think in this past year a lot of people have connected with the environment around them in a way that they haven't before, right? Blackfellas have had this connection for a long time, but you're seeing broader Australian society maybe appreciate birds and that landscape. Do you feel like this connection is something that more people can find a deeper understanding of?
I think that's very true. Our mob always say you've got to learn about the natural world by observing it. With your cultural knowledge behind you. But scientific studies are showing this now, that the secret to mental health and happiness is spending time in nature. And it's self-evident to First Nations people because we've always been raised to see it, to observe it, to not feel greater than it and not always try and feel a part of it and respect it. So it's been, I mean, one of the unexpected joys of lockdown has been having an opportunity to watch the natural world. And I think taking solace in the natural world is a really important thing to do. And if we did, maybe so many of our native birds wouldn't be on the endangered list.
So, Lorena, are you voting for the magpie this year?
This year I've been voting for the black cockatoo because after the catastrophic bushfires on the south coast, they are endangered, and I can't imagine, I couldn't bear living in a world where there weren't black cockatoos. So if you love birds and you want to save them, maybe it's time to vote.
Next, how the past 2 years has pushed some birds to the brink of extinction and what you can do about it.
My name is Lisa Cox. I'm Guardian Australia's environment reporter, and I am backing Team Superb Fairy Wren. They are small and dramatic. Can't put my finger on why that might resonate with me. They're also just really beautiful little birds that I used to see a lot when I was growing up. I used to see superb fairy wrens, particularly the male ones because they've got the lovely blue feathers. I'd see them a lot on my grandmother's property on the Central Coast. And I also lived in Canberra for several years when I was working as a reporter there, and they were quite a common bird to see on my street in Kingston and down by the lake. And I just love them, and everybody should vote for them.
How are they going at the moment? Are they going well?
Sadly, I've had to report in this year's launch piece for Bird of the Year that we are actually recording some declines of the superb fairy wren, and that's actually something that people should be really worried about. They're not currently listed as a threatened species, and they are a bird that you used to be able to commonly see around urban areas. But what BirdLife have told us is that their monitoring over the last 7 years or so through their Aussie backyard bird count is showing that the rate at which people are recording sightings of these birds and other urban species is actually on the decline.
Mm. So another bird that's in decline is the gangang cockatoo. And I know you've been speaking to people about this bird. Can you tell me about that?
Gangangs are really beautiful little birds. They're a small grey cockatoo, and the male birds are very easily recognised because they have lovely bright red feathers on their faces. Oh, I don't want to call them my backup bird, but they're my number two bird for Bird of the Year. I've encouraged people to vote for the superb fairy wren, but if they must choose another, the gangang is an absolutely excellent choice. And another bird that's very, very common to Canberra, it's the faunal emblem for Canberra, actually.
What else do we need to know about them?
They're a species that you find around the east coast of Australia. And when I was doing some research for our Bird of the Year series of stories, I spoke to a lovely woman by the name of Carol Probertz in the Blue Mountains. Mm. And Carol is an avid bird watcher. She's the vice president of the Blue Mountains Bird Observers, a group that's been operating in the Blue Mountains since the early 90s. And they record birds that they see in the local area. And through doing that, they've actually compiled this just incredible database of species that are known to the area or have been known to the area over many, many years. Carol herself has actually been keeping notes since the 1980s. And one of the things that she told me when I spoke to her was that they've got records of gangangs being a really, really common species around the Blue Mountains, to the point that there's actually a street in Katoomba called Gangang Street.
And so she's got notes in her notebook from the 1980s saying, you know, one gangang Wednesday, 3rd of September.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're talking about. And since the group has been seriously operating, like, they've got a lot of data on this particular bird. And what she told me was that there's been a really notable decline in gangang sightings over particularly the last decade.
What did she find? I mean, what is the data that they have on the gang gang?
In 1992, 62% of all of their surveys recorded gang gang sightings, and in 8 of the last 10 years, that number has dropped to 20%.
Mm. And so what is the reason for this? What's happened with the gang gang?
Well, if we're talking broadly about gang gang numbers, the gang gang is actually under assessment right now by the Threatened Species Scientific Committee, which is an independent committee that advises the federal government about which species are under threat. And the gang gang is currently under assessment for its first ever listing as a threatened species. And the really concerning thing is that it's being assessed for an endangered listing, which is just one step away from critically endangered, which is a step away from extinction. Mm. It's a really, really serious listing if this goes ahead, and it gives you an idea of the extent of the decline, that they would be starting at that level rather than starting at a vulnerable listing. And there's a number of reasons for that. So monitoring of the birds across their range had shown that they were in decline. And one of the main reasons that this is occurring is because of changes to our climate. They're under threat from heat waves, and they're also under threat from increasing fires. And when the bushfire disaster occurred, that actually burnt 36% of their range, so the sort of known areas of habitat. That's really up there with some of the worst effects for species that we've seen in Australia through that disaster.
Mm, it's been a big 2 years for climate-related disasters in Australia. And as you say, the Black Summer bushfires were devastating. How did that impact birds and wildlife more broadly?
Yeah, so when we launched the last Bird of the Year poll, it was November 2019, which was, we didn't know at that point, but it turned out to actually just be the early stages of Australia's most catastrophic bushfire season. So without a doubt, the biggest change that we've seen for all of our wildlife, and that includes all of our wonderful bird species, is the impact of those bushfires. I think really early on we became quickly aware of the potential extent of these fires on all of our wildlife. A peer-reviewed study by three ecology professors last June found the fires had caused the most dramatic loss of habitat for threatened species and devastation of ecological communities in post-colonial history.
Mm.
And we also had a report from the Worldwide Fund for Nature, which estimated that 180 million birds were affected by the fires. That's out of 3 billion animals overall. The impact of these fires is something that researchers and government agencies are going to be continuing to study for a long time. So there are immediate impacts that we became aware of very quickly, but the longer term impacts are things that we're going to learn over years and decades. And so, and that's absolutely the case for some of our birds, many of which are actually being assessed right now by our Threatened Species Scientific Committee to consider whether they need to actually be listed as threatened for the first time, if they're already threatened, whether they might need to have that listing upgraded.
Right. So how many birds may now be added to the endangered list after all of this?
So since the fires, there have been 16 new bird species put under assessment for either a listing for the first time or for an upgraded listing because the declines have worsened as a result of the fires. So one of those is the gang gang, and then there's another 15 animals that they're looking at. And what the Threatened Species Scientific Committee have told me is that there's more to come. So those 16, they're just the first ones that they're looking at. There will be more that will be assessed in future.
Mm. So, Lisa, a lot of people get around Bird of the Year. It's a source of much debate, and also sure I think is. Brings a lot of people together as well. How can people get involved outside of Bird of the Year if they're looking for ways to help with these conservation efforts to make sure that some of these birds survive within our lifetimes and beyond?
Sure. There's lots of different things that people can do depending on what their area of interest is. You know, they could become volunteers with local wildlife organisations if that's something that people have the time for an interest in doing. They can
they could join Carol's group in the Blue Mountains if they're there.
Exactly. They can donate to conservation organisations, wildlife care organisations. But there's also much smaller things that people can do if you're fortunate enough to live in a home with a backyard or a garden. You know, you can think about the types of plants and trees that you're planting in your garden, and plant species that will attract birds, particularly, you know, some of the smaller urban bird populations. They like sort of denser, shrubbier kinds of plants. And so those are the sorts of things that if you're wanting to attract superb fairy wrens back to the area, that's the sort of things that you should be looking at.
Just one example.
Just one example. I don't know why that one came to mind, but yeah, superb fairy wrens.
If you're interested in voting in Bird of the Year 2021, you are in luck. You can vote right now. This year, the bottom five birds are eliminated at the end of each weekday, with everyone able to vote again in the next round each day. But voting does finish on Thursday, and the winner is announced this Friday, so time is of the essence. We've put a link to where you can vote on the Full Story page, but you can find it on the Guardian website at any time. We've also put some links to some of the stories that were featured in this episode as well. That's it for today. Thanks to everyone in this episode who shared their bird stories and to Guardian's off-platform team for gathering the celebrity bird endorsements. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria and Camilla Hannan, who also did the sound design. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson and myself, Laura Murphy Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.